Good afternoon. This is Bob Krueger with Thought for Food for November 2012. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it will be of interest to everyone. The month of November begins with All Saints Day on the 1st, and on the 4th, Daylight Saving Time ends for this year. Election Day is on the 6th, and on the 11th, we observe Veterans Day. In Canada, this day is called Remembrance Day. This year, Thanksgiving comes the earliest possible day for the 4th Thursday, the 22nd, and I end the month with a birthday on the 29th. As crops are being harvested this time of year, it's interesting to learn that 2012 has been a good year for North Carolina farmers. In 10 generations of farming, the same piece of Wake County land, the Burt family has seldom seen weather as kind as it has been this year. This is one of those great years, said Fred Burt, who now helps his son John run the 700-acre farm outside of Fuquay Varina. That's not true most of the time, but this is a good year, I'll admit it. For crop farmers, weather is the biggest factor determining whether they make a profit or even earn enough to cover the bills. The 2012 growing season wasn't perfect. It included a late freeze that damaged apples in the mountains. In some places, there was too much or too little rain. But the season was notable for what didn't happen. No widespread drought, no relentless rains, no rash of tornadoes, and no major hurricane. Agriculture is still North Carolina's largest industry, accounting for more than $70 billion in income each year, according to the State Department of Agriculture and Consumer Service. About two-thirds of that comes from livestock production, mostly poultry and pigs, whose growers struggled this year because of soaring feed prices. The remainder is counted in bushels, bales, and pounds. While some of this year's crops, peanuts, corn, and soybeans are still being harvested and Christmas trees haven't begun to be cut, reports so far indicate average or better yields. Prices, too, are generally better than last year. It's the kind of year that farmers keep hanging on, Burt says. In farming, you've got to be able to live for 9 or 10 months of the year with all the money going out for fertilizer, seed, equipment, or repairs, he said. You only make your money in the last couple of months of the year, and sometimes you don't make much then. Not being able to make it through the lean months or the lean years makes it tempting for farmers to sell their land, most often to developers. Since 2002, North Carolina has lost more than 6,000 farms and 600,000 acres that have been moved out of the agriculture production, making the state the national leader in farmland loss. The state now has about 52,000 working farms. In 2005, the state legislature established the Farmland Preservation Trust Fund, designed to support the use of private land for farming, forestry, and horticulture. The recession has reduced the development pressure on farmland, says DeWitt Hardy, who manages the program for the Department of Agriculture, but I see it ramping back up mainly because so many people continue to move to North Carolina. To celebrate farmers who stay on the land, state agriculture officials launched a search in 1970 to find those who had owned or operated a North Carolina farm for 100 years or more. In its first luncheon at the North Carolina State Fair, the Century Farm Program honored more than 800 families. The Century Farm family reunions are held at the fair every 4 years. This took place this year during this year's State Fair, and some 1,600 families, including the Burts, are now on the list, representing every county in the state except for Dare and Swaim. To the last 100 years, farm families have had to adapt, said Kent Messick, chief of field services for the department's agronomic division. While tobacco still is a valuable crop worth more than $589 million to the state in 2010, many farmers have switched to other commodities since the end of the quota and price support system. Even cotton, which made a comeback in the 1990s, is expecting to be less profitable over time because of competition from India and China. In the past 5 years, Messick says, more growers are planting new crops such as canola, rapeseed, and clary sage, all produced for their oil. For generations after his family got their land in a grant from King George II, Bert says they planted mostly corn, cotton, and tobacco. When he took over the farm, he grew tobacco too, but when he got called to active duty with the North Carolina National Guard in 1990 and had to leave the country, he rented his tobacco land to another farmer. When he came back, he decided to grow something else, and now he produces three varieties of hay for horses: alfalfa, orchard grass, and a hybrid coastal Bermuda. Horse people are picky, Bert says, but we have a good product. People want it, and we can set our own prices. Customers come from far away as Wilmington, and the Burts don't even advertise. In competition at this year's state fair, the Burts hay took three ribbons. Bert and his son also raised some beef cattle. In 2008, they built a horse barn, and next year began boarding horses. Some owners come out every day to visit their animals in one of the pastures or ride them in the rings around the farm paths. At last count in 2007, Wake County had only 827 farms left, and the average age of the farmer was 59. Bert is a year older than that. John Bert, 30, plans to keep farming this land. What will his son do with the farm? It's too early to say, John said. While we Americans complain about the price of food, we are guilty of wasting a good bit of what we buy. According to a new report from the Natural Resources Defense Council, we waste up to 40% of the country's food supply each year. This analysis, a compilation of various studies and statistics, found that the waste exists from farm to fork. The average family of four squanders $2,275 in food each year, or 20 pounds of food per person per month, according to the nonprofit and nonpartisan environmental group. Food waste is the largest single part of the solid waste cramming America's landfills. Since the 1970s, the amount of uneaten food that's dumped has increased 50%. The average American trashes 10 times the food as a consumer in Southeast Asia, according to the NRDC. Such wasteful practices are especially unwarranted in a time of recent drought, high food prices expected to go higher, and families unable to afford food, the report says. Efforts are already in place in Europe to cut back on food waste. But American consumers are used to seeing pyramids of fresh produce in their local markets and grocery stores, which result in $15 billion annually in unsold fruit and vegetables, according to the NRDC. In restaurants and in home kitchens, massive portions mean that part of that serving often end up in the trash. Key resources are used for agriculture. The study says wasted food eats up a quarter of all the fresh water consumed in the United States, along with 4% of the oil, while producing 23% of the methane emissions. In this report, the council urges the government to set a target for food waste reduction. Companies should look for alternatives in their supply chain, such as making baby carrots out of carrots too bent to be sold whole at the retail level. The study also asks Americans to learn when food goes bad and be less averse to buying scarred or otherwise imperfect produce. The average consumer should also save and eat leftovers, researchers said. Perhaps this tale of woe gives us a picture of how we Americans think when we buy produce. Susan Russo, who writes a food column, begins, "My local market recently had a sale on apples. I spent 10 minutes carefully selecting the most perfectly shaped, shiny Max, Rome Beauties, and Pink Ladies I could find. I gently place my bags of apples on the conveyor belt at the checkout. As I begin to unload my remaining groceries from the corner of my eye, I saw my apples disappear from the belt, bam, onto the scales, then bam, into grocery bags. Before I could say a word, it was too late. My previously pristine apples were irrevocably spotted with unsightly blemishes. Rather than try to eat around the bruises, I did what any resourceful cook would do. I made applesauce. Homemade applesauce is infinitely better than that in a can or a jar. It doesn't have any additives or preservatives. It's healthier, too. Plus, when you make it yourself, your entire house smells like a fresh baked apple pie, and that's reason enough not to buy that on the grocery shelf." She continues, "I use sweet, juicy, meaty apples such as Rome Beauties or Macintosh. I leave the skin on one or two apples to impart a warm, reddish color to the sauce. If you don't like the texture of the skin, you can remove it before serving or puree the sauce until it dissolves. For a basic apple sauce, I use apples, water, cinnamon, and sugar. For variety, sometimes add a splash of fresh lemon juice or some ground nutmeg, ginger, or cloves. golden raisins or fresh or dried cranberries are also wonderful additions. I think Ms. Russo is one who deals well when things don't go right. In our September program, I mentioned that a company was looking for a site and trying to establish a rooftop garden. Bright Farms builds hydrophobic, that's growing in water, greenhouses on tops of building, then sells the lettuce, tomatoes, and herbs to local supermarkets. They asked folks to submit an offer in 200 words or less, and now we learn such a site has been located. The winner of the contest was Kelly Kenworthy, a growth advisor from Los Angeles who submitted six sites, including the 200,000 square foot Evergreen packing facility on South Wilmington Street here in Raleigh. Evergreen is the manufacturer and supplier of consumer food and beverage packaging and storage. Bright Farms will finance, build, and manage the greenhouse farm. Participating supermarkets sign 10-year contracts to purchase the produce and receive a guarantee that prices will never exceed the average inflation rate. We're looking forward to securing an ideal site so we can build a farm and grow the freshest local produce for North Carolina supermarket chain in 2013. Paul Lightfoot, the Bright Farms CEO, said in a statement, the company has partnered with A&P and Brooklyn, Whole Foods in New Jersey, and Homeland Stores in Oklahoma. You bacon lovers can relax. You can find all you need on supermarket shelves in the coming months, although your pocketbooks may take a hit. The economics of the current drought are likely to nose up prices for bacon and other pork products next year as much as 10%. But U.S. agricultural economists are dismissing reports of a global bacon shortage that lent sizzle to recent headlines. Simply put, the talk of scarcity is hogwash. The use of the word shortage caused visions of the 1970s-style gasoline lines in a lot of people's heads, and that's not the case, said Steve Meyer, a consultant to the National Pork Producers Council and National Pork Board. If the definition of shortage is that you can't find it on the shelves, then no, the concern is not valid. If the concern is a higher cost for it, then yes. Fears about a scarcity of bacon swept across social and mainstream media in recent weeks after Great Britain's National Pig Association said a bacon shortage was unavoidable, citing a sharp decline in the continent's pig herd and drought-inflated feed costs. The report caused such consternation over a product that used to be merely a breakfast staple, but nowadays flavor everything from brownies to vodka. The alarm was quickly dismissed by the American Farm Bureau Federation as baloney. Pork supplies will decrease slightly as we go into 2013, Farm Bureau economist John Anderson said. But the idea there will be widespread shortages that will run out of pork, that's overblown. The stubborn drought in the United States, the world's largest supplier of feed grains, undeniably will affect pig production. The Corn Belt's lack of moisture has twice prompted the USDA to slash its forecast for this year's corn crop. The government now expects the U.S. production of grain to 10.8 billion bushels, the least since 2006. These lowered expectations sent the corn price of corn also used in ethanol, further squeezing supply to record highs through much of the summer. Feed generally makes up about 60% of the expense of raising a hog, and rather than absorbing the higher costs, swine and beef producers often color animals by sending them to slaughter. A pound of sliced bacon in our local supermarkets averages close to $4 a pound. Hog producer Phil Borgick waves off the concerns about consumers facing shortages. The U.S. has plenty of pork, Borgick says, who has 3,400 sows in central Illinois. We'll have some price inflation, but we'll have plenty of supply. After sampling 95 cheeses from around the state and beyond, judges of a second annual North Carolina State Fair International Cheese Composition chose a winner from the Triangle. And a Sago cheese from the Chapel Hill Creamery won the title of Best of North Carolina and Best in Show, beating cheeses from Australia, Texas, Maine, Tennessee, and elsewhere in North Carolina. It's got a real nice, intense, nutty, and fruity flavor that got a lot of depth to it, said Mary Ann Drake, the head judge and professor of sensory analysis and flavor chemistry at NC State University. Judges began the six-hour process of tasting cheese from 19 cheesemakers at 7:30 a.m. A technical judge and an aesthetic judge each evaluated half of the cheeses based on the criteria from the American Cheese Society. A local food blogger joined in so the cheese could be judged from a consumer's point of view, said Steve Lathrop, the State Department of Agriculture spokesman. All five judges evaluated the four finalists. Winning cheeses say true in their type in terms of flavor, texture, and feel in the mouth, says Michelle LaCanta, the aesthetic judge and regional associate coordinator at Whole Foods Market. They have a nice, lingering, fresh, nothing off tasting, she said. The American Cheese Society held its annual conference in Raleigh in August, which allowed the State Department of Agriculture to recruit cheesemakers for the state fair competition, Lathrop said. There were only 23 entries last year, and Chapel Hill Creamery won the 2011 competition as well. Co-owner Portia McKnight says the creamery's careful attention to detail from start to finish makes its cheeses stand out. That's why the creamery owns its own cows. We're very insistent on excellent health in our herd, McKnight says. We're very proud of our animal crowd, and that leads us to great milk. Mary Ann Drake's sister, Stephanie Drake, was a technical judge. She's a principal scientist for the Daisy brand dairy products in Garland, Texas, and tastes a lot of dairy products, but never 40-some cheeses in one day. The task seems daunting at first, she said. But to keep their edge, Stephanie Drake said, the judges drank lots of water, took their time between cheeses, and ate unsalted plain crackers to cleanse their palates between entries. They didn't actually eat the cheese. The judges sniffed and tasted each one before spitting it out. They don't eat the cheese. Just when I was ready to volunteer to become a cheese judge. With all of the discussion about sugary drinks, the American Beverage Association is working to present a positive outlook. Soft drink machines in Chicago and San Antonio government buildings will carry calorie information, and city workers will be able to win cash in a health competition paid for by Coca-Cola and other beverage giants under a new program recently announced. Other places are giving the boot to soda machines or taxing sugary drinks. We mentioned this in last month's program. But Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel said this new approach to the health issue is better because it emphasizes personal responsibility. City workers in San Antonio and Chicago will compete for a $5 million grant from the American Beverage Association. The nationwide soda lobbying group will pay $1,000 to individuals who meet as yet unspecified health care goals. The group said soda vending machines in the two cities' municipal buildings will be among the first in the country to get the calorie count displays next year before the program goes nationwide. New York City adopted a rule last month barring many types of business from selling sugary drinks in containers larger than 16 ounces. Appearing at City Hall with representatives of Coke, Pepsi, and Dr. Pepper companies, Emanuel said he didn't want to pursue cola serving size limits like New York's or to approve a proposed tax on sugary drinks. Emanuel says the program isn't a payoff for the cola industry to avoid future punitive measures. I firmly believe in personal responsibility, the mayor said in a City Hall news conference with beverage company executives. I believe in competition, and I believe in cash rewards for people that actually make progress in managing their health care. If you basically put aside personal responsibility, you're missing the core ingredient for improving health outcomes, he said when asked about a tax on drinks. Susan Neely, president and CEO of the American Beverage Association, said those types of curbs don't work. We think these kind of things are going to get a lot further faster than bans or fights over discriminatory taxes, which there's research after research says will not work. They will not change behavior, Neely said at the news conference with Emanuel. He said the exact details of the health competition were being worked out, but mentioned losing weight and quitting smoking as likely benchmarks that would help a worker earn money. The American Beverage Association said the new program complements previous initiatives such as putting new calorie labels on beverage packaging and removing full calorie soft drinks from schools. Sugar drinks have been a focus in the country's debate over rising obesity rates among children and adults. Steve Kahillian, the president and CEO of Coca-Cola Refreshments, says it's unfair to simply target soda when looking for causes of America's obesity program. Sugar-sweetened beverages, on average, are about 7% of the diet. Because we're part of a diet, then, of course, we're part of the problem. But it's a broad problem, and it's energy balance. Calories in, calories out, he said. I think we want to learn of the finer details of the competition. This will be interest to those of us who like tomatoes year-round. Mexico and the United States are gearing up for a showdown over fresh tomatoes, a $3.5 billion business for the two countries, and a move that could boost the fortunes of some American tomato farmers but raise prices for U.S. consumers. Growers in Florida have demanded cuts in imports from Mexico, and it appears that Washington is inclined to support the Floridians and the few farmers from other states who have joined the complaint. That would require ending a 16-year-old trade agreement and endangers tens of thousands of jobs on both sides of the border, especially in border states, advocates for Mexican tomatoes say. It also would probably increase the cost to U.S. consumers of fresh tomatoes, though it's unclear how much Mexico provides us. Mexico provides us with about half of the fresh tomatoes we consume. Most of the rest are grown in Florida, the United States' number one producer of fresh tomatoes, closely followed by California. In the past decade, Mexican growers have increased tomato production. In 2000, fresh tomato exports totaled $412 million worth. By 2011, the figure had jumped to $181 billion worth. U.S. importers of the Mexican varieties say they are tasty, cheaper, and more plentiful year-round. The Florida growers contend that Mexican lowballs its prices and makes fair competition impossible, and they ask the Department of Commerce to intervene. The department filed notice of intent to grant the Florida growers' petition, a move that would allow them to formally accuse Mexican producers of illegal dumping. The decision, though preliminary, infuriated Mexico and a host of U.S. companies supporting the Mexican tomato, including major grocery and grocery chains and California importers. "We're very disappointed," said Francisco D. Rosenwig, Mexico's top foreign trade official. He said Mexican producers are especially stunned because the commerce decision came just one day before an initial meeting the two sides were to have discussing renegotiating the trade pact. "There are fears of a wider trade war if Mexican retaliates by trying to resist the tons of U.S. meat, poultry, grains, and other agricultural products that normally Mexico buys. Mexico is our largest destination for exports overall after Canada." De Rosenwig did not rule out a reprisal. "This is a time we need more commerce, not less, since less hurts jobs and economic recovery," he said. Many in favor of the Mexican tomatoes suspect presidential election politics have a role in this dispute, with Floridians using their state's status as a swing vote could put pressure on the Obama administration. The Florida lobbyists have been pressing for an early decision from the Commerce Department that would come before the U.S. elections. Normally, this type of action takes 9 months, but they say the reason for the haste is that growers need to make decisions now for the next planting season. Mexico is blessed with lower labor costs, good weather, and rich soil, and tomatoes are its largest legal agricultural export. The growth in sales to the U.S. of fresh American tomatoes has contributed to a thriving industry that employs 350,000 people in Mexico. At current production rates, Mexican earnings were on course to top $2 billion this year. Mexican production got a big push in the years after World War II, when American businessmen were looking for ways to provide fresh vegetables to the U.S. consumers. Total U.S. production of fresh market tomatoes was valued at $1.3 billion in 2009, the most recent data available. Last week's preliminary ruling was to suspend a pact between the Mexican growers and the U.S. Department of Commerce, in force since 1996, that sets prices for fresh tomato imports and is meant to guarantee fair trade. Interested parties have 40 days to file objections. If they do this, it will be devastating for the U.S. importing energy industry and for the Mexican tomato exporting industry, said Lance Jungmeier, president of the Fresh Produce Association of the Americas, an Arizona-based trade group that promotes the U.S. import of produce from Mexico. If they, Florida growers, can put protection measures on Mexican tomatoes, they will corner the market for themselves. If only the tomatoes in our grocery store, either Floridian or Mexican, had a little more flavor. I believe that everyone, unless allergic to it, loves chocolate, but the efforts of some food manufacturers seems a bit far-fetched in attempts to cash in on our love for chocolate. Here are some examples. Have you tried the new chocolate cream of wheat hot cereal? Have any of our listeners had a chance to try this chocolate version? If so, I would welcome your comments about it. I'm curious, but I don't want to buy a whole box of the cereal just for a taste. Other examples of the chocolate parade is chocolate-flavored Philadelphia cream cheese spread. They also make a pumpkin pie cream cheese. In the cereal aisle of the grocery store, I found a Kellogg cereal called Crave, spelled K-R-A-V-E, that's chocolate-flavored. I also found chocolate Frosted Flakes and chocolate Cheerios. I'll not be surprised at any attempt to present some food product in a chocolate version. Red Bull, the brand that makes energy drinks hip, is about to offer something it's never tried before, flavors. The company has announced plans for cranberry, lime, and blueberry-flavored Red Bull to be sold in red, silver, and blue cans. They will be called Red Bull Editions and be available next March. The move comes at a time when the growing competition in the energy drink category, which researcher Mintel projects will grow to nearly $12 billion in the next 5 years. Energy drink sales have rocketed as Target has expanded well beyond students cramming for exams or mixing it with alcohol at parties to a wider market, including office workers and truck drivers. Red Bull's action might appear to be a signal that is playing catch-up with rivals Monster, Rockstar, and even Starbucks refreshers that have a lot of flavor options, but Red Bull said it's simply responding to a consumer demand. Taste is a barrier for the category, and taste is a barrier for Red Bull, said Amy Taylor, the vice president of marketing. After 12 years in the United States, we can now introduce flavors without confusion. It's about expanding our consumer base. In test marketing, the new flavors resulted in 60% increased sales growth, Taylor said. Although she declined to be specific, Taylor hinted that this may be just the beginning of flavor expansion. We have the intention to grow this category and this brand, even when Red Bull is late to the flavor party. Brand consultant Robert Pasikoff says this is the kind of thing they should have gotten off in front of. In this category, what delights people today becomes expected tomorrow. Monster Energy Drink, which declined to comment, got out front of flavor option years ago. Monster's domestic market share in volume is 34.8%. It's bigger than Red Bull's. But in 2012 dollar volume, Red Bull leads with a 42% share versus the 35 share for Monster, Nielsen said. Red Bull's done awfully well, and it's hard to second guess their choice, Beverly Digest editor John Sicker said. But consumers do like choice. There's no end in sight for growth in this category. Last year, the category saw 16% volume growth, Sicker said. Until next month at this time, this has been Bob Krueger with Thought for Food. As we approach Thanksgiving Day, let us think of the many things we have to be thankful for. Let's appreciate the little things in life that make us happy. My very best wishes to everyone who prepares a Thanksgiving meal. May everything turn out well. Take care.